Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. About 700 Confederate monuments remain standing in the United States. Some regard them as a painful reminder of the nation's history of slavery and white supremacy. Others believe that the monuments are part of history that should not be erased for political correctness. New Orleans has become a flashpoint in the controversy. Since 2015, that city's mayor, Mitch Landrieu, has led a movement to remove the monuments from public sites in the city. He addressed the issue in May.
These statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments celebrate a fictional, sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, ignoring the enslavement, ignoring the terror that it actually stood for.
We're talking about the history and contemporary significance of the monuments in Ohio and across the country. Alan Blinder covers the South for the New York Times. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The movement to remove the monuments is not new. Why the increased interest now?
You know, and I think we can trace this particular round of opposition to Confederate monuments really back to 2 years ago over the weekend when a young white supremacist walked into a Charleston, South Carolina church and killed nine black churchgoers. And it was after that episode at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston that state lawmakers in South Carolina moved to bring down the Confederate battle flag that had flown outside the state house for decades. And it was that moment that really seemed to galvanize a renewed round of opposition to Confederate symbols. And that episode in Charleston, the success that lawmakers had in Columbia helped spur the mayor of New Orleans and other leaders around the South to take a new look at the monuments that are, frankly, all over the Deep South.
New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu is white, the first white mayor there in a while. Why him and not one of the African-American mayors before him to lead the charge there?
You know, I think there are a lot of questions about that. That's been one of the issues that has come up in New Orleans. I remember talking a month or so ago with an opponent of the mayor's plan to bring down the four monuments in New Orleans that Mayor Landrieu targeted, and he posed the same question: why not any of the previous African American mayors? There are some people in New Orleans who argue that Mayor Landrieu was doing this for political convenience, that he wants to have a rising profile on the national stage, so maybe it had something to do with that. But other people said he needed something like what happened in Charleston to be able to really rally support for removing those kinds of monuments. He's been fighting it since 2015. The fight to remove those monuments, though, went through the courts. There was some legislative resistance. So the fact that they just came down this spring, not indicative of it just coming up again. It's been a 2-year fight, roughly.
And decades long, if you look at the larger movement, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you look, I'm based in Atlanta, and Georgia had a fight, almost 20 years ago about whether the Confederate battle flag could be on the state's flag. Mississippi's having the same fight. They've been fighting it and arguing about it for decades.
So the Charleston, South Carolina shooting incident, riveted a lot of attention on the flag. But what about other monuments in South Carolina and that kind of a thing? Why so much on the flag and not the statuary?
You know, that was one of the debates that surfaced. And I was at the State House for a few days of protracted and emotional debate. And some people worried that the flag coming down would be essentially the first thing and the other statues would follow. And South Carolina, the flag was seen simply as the most contentious of all the symbolism for the Confederacy in South Carolina. I mean, it had a prominent place on the grounds of the state capitol. It flew at the end of Main Street, right when you'd walk down Main Street toward the State House in Columbia. You'd come to the battle flag before you'd come to the steps of the state capitol. And it was seen as simply as a monument to white supremacy. It was not a flag that was put up at the State House in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War or anything. It was erected at the height of integration disputes, and it was seen as frankly a thumb at the nose of people who supported integration. It was seen as a manifestation of white supremacy. It was not seen simply as recognizing Southern Confederate heritage. It was seen as an act of racism to have erected the flag and put it where it was in the first place.
Since the New Orleans removed those last vestiges, how has it affected folks in other Confederate monument-heavy states and cities?
You know, we've seen some movement against some monuments. There's been debate in Memphis. There has been debate in St. Louis. In Alabama, there was a bill that passed the legislature this year. It had been introduced last year and failed, but it passed the legislature this year. It was signed by the governor that really added new protections for monuments on public property. It sharply restricts movements of Confederate monuments, memorials, the naming of schools that might be named for Confederate war heroes, and it passed the legislature this spring and was signed by the governor. So there is resistance to this movement of removing Confederate flags. At the same time, there have been other victories for support of Confederate symbols. I mean, I read over the weekend that a city in Mississippi, Macomb, which is in southern Mississippi, not far from the Louisiana line, They furled the state flag outside City Hall because the state flag still has the Confederate battle flag on it.
Mayor Landrieu has said that removal of the monuments in New Orleans will foster reconciliation. Is he talking about anything concrete, or is it just a feeling, or what?
Yeah, from what I can tell, it's a feeling. And there are some people in New Orleans who argue that it's, even people who wanted the Confederate monuments to come down, they're not sure this will actually have the effect of reconciliation. New Orleans did not remove every Confederate monument in the city or every controversial monument in the city. It removed four of them. So some people have questioned, if you're taking down these four, why not other disputed monuments and memorials? And then there are opponents of the removal in the first place who think that the mayor is trying to sanitize history, and it will do nothing to foster reconciliation. So I think it remains to be seen whether the mayor and the city will move forward with anything else in the future. The mayor is in his last year as mayor. Mm-hmm. There is a contentious election developing to succeed him. The legislature has signaled that it was not thrilled, at least some members of the legislature, they were not thrilled with what happened in New Orleans. So it's likely to be an issue that hangs around for some number of years, and whether anything will move forward beyond that, it's entirely unclear at this point.
A USA Today story published in May said that the number of Confederate monuments is increasing, actually. In North Carolina, 35 have been added since 2000, according to a University of North Carolina survey. What's going on with that?
You know, I haven't done a great deal of reporting on the rise of them. I've focused a lot more on the battles over the existing ones, the ones that have been there for 50, 60 years in some cases, and in some cases even longer than that. But I think what you're seeing is some communities, frankly, feeling a resentment. They feel like places like South Carolina have been bullied by outside forces, if you will, to take down these types of symbols. They feel heritage is under threat, and you know, we've seen these types of protection bills come up in the past when there was resistance to Confederate symbols. Part of the reason South Carolina had such a protracted fight was South Carolina had argued about the fate of the Confederate flag back in 2000, and there was a law that was in place that was passed as part of a compromise that people thought would settle the issue for a good long while, and then 15 years later, it was back because of another news event. So you see people in some communities wonder, essentially, what's going to be next? When will people be wanting to change how we honor heritage? And that's, I think, what you see. You see some entrenched resistance.
Are there monuments to the Union and the history of blacks who endured enslavement in the South? Or is there anything like that?
In some places, but the ones that get the most attention in the Deep South are in fact monuments to the Confederacy. I mean, and just outside of Atlanta, there is a large public area, a large mountain, basically called Stone Mountain, and
right.
A large granite rock, and there's I mean, there's a relief of honors the Confederacy. Yes, so those are the ones that really get the most attention, and even things that would seem to honor Union efforts in the Deep South are sometimes seen as being more of Confederate honors. There's a painting in Atlanta called the Cyclorama. It's a huge painting, and it depicts the Battle of Atlanta. It was designed to show the Northern victory in Atlanta, and over the generations, it became seen as a kind of a gathering place for people to talk about Confederate heritage. So it can be complicated.
The removal process comes at a price. It costs New Orleans over $2 million to do all of this, and part of that involves storage. What is the idea about what to do with these monuments once they're removed?
You know, in South Carolina, they took the battle flag, and it's been moved to a museum. That's where a number of Republicans and Democrats said it belonged. In New Orleans, they're still sorting out what to do with it. Yeah, it's one of these. A lot of times, people want to bring down these monuments and sort out what to do with them later. South Carolina was a fairly rare case in which they knew what they wanted to do as soon as it came down, which was put it in the Confederate Relic Room in Columbia, not far from the state capitol.
This has created some strange bedfellows, has it not? I mean, there's some people who would consider themselves, you know, anti-segregation, anti-slavery, anti-white supremacy. But as history buffs or historians disagree with this movement?
I think so. I mean, you've had a wide array of force come together in some places. In South Carolina, there was bipartisan support to remove the battle flag. A Republican governor signed it. A Republican legislature passed it. But in Alabama this year, you had really Republicans and Democrats on starkly different sides of this debate. On the monuments bill, there have been times where you've seen political bodies and political entities really come together and form unusual alliances, to say the least. But that's not always the case. It's sporadic at best.
Is it a Democrat versus Republican issue?
I don't think so. I mean, we've seen in some places, like I said, you'll see Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
It could be in harmony on the issue. I think a lot of the time it depends on the geography and political terrain of a particular state. I mean, one of the most powerful moments in the South Carolina debate 2 years ago was when a white woman from the Charleston area, a member of the legislature, spoke against the battle flag in the state outside the state house. Her remark, and she made her speech very, very late in the debate, really helped turn the tide, if you will, and ensure that the flag was coming down. There were some signals in the House that it was going to be a difficult debate. She got up in the well of the House, made an absolutely remarkable speech to a lot of people, and that was seen as a crucial moment in the debate. So there had been impassioned speeches by many other people, but it was a white woman Republican from the Charleston area who had been in this pivotal.
Alan Blinder, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Alan Blinder covers the South for the New York Times. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at the issue, and I'll talk about a couple of Confederate monuments here in Ohio. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 700 monuments to the Confederacy still stand in the U.S. A decades-old movement to remove them from public property has gained a foothold, most recently in New Orleans in May, where the remaining handful were taken down, some in the dark of night. The effort is controversial. Historians and history buffs alike condemn the removals as a style of censorship and whitewashing of history. Proponents, including New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, have said that there's a difference between remembrance and reverence of history. Ohio State Professor Joan Cashin is an expert on the 19th century South. She joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also, New York Times visual journalist and producer Logan Jaffe co-produced the 2015 film documentary entitled Battle Flag. The film questions the meaning of the Confederate flag more than 150 years after the end of the Civil War. Logan Jaffe joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Logan, how is the flag different or the same as monuments to the Confederacy, like, you know, marble and concrete?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I've talked to a number of historians when I was making the Battle Flag documentary. One of them, his name is John Kosky, and he like basically wrote the book called The Confederate Battle Flag. And he points out towards the end of the book that a lot of people see the flag and controversies and issues around the flag as kind of the first line for a larger public discussion about what to do with the landscape in general. So I think the flag is kind of the first, you know, it's kind of almost, it's an issue in itself, but it's also a segue to a larger conversation about what we want the landscape to look like and what's worth remembering.
As far as the flag goes, Joan Cashin, that emerged not right after the war at all, as far as a symbol.
That's correct. The Confederate flag was added to the various state flags for the most part in the mid-20th century, the 1950s and 60s, usually as a protest against the civil rights movement and to try to assert support for segregation.
So that was something that was voted on, that was adjudicated and voted on at the time.
Sometimes it was just a decision by the governor.
an executive decision that one fought against.
Yes. Although there have always been white Southerners who disagreed with it, just as there were white Southerners who were against the Civil War, against secession.
But it wasn't popular to say so at the time.
Some of them said so and got arrested for it.
You know, that idea that this movement to take down the monuments, to get rid of the flag or move it to a museum. A lot of people say this just popped up in 2015. It's decades long, right, Logan Jaffe?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it goes back decades and decades. I think what's important to remember about monuments is, you know, they're not all put up right after the Civil War. It's really important to look at the dates that they were put up. And by who? And I know in regards to the battle flag, I mean, that made a huge resurgence during, you know, school desegregation, for example. It's an ongoing issue that has gone back, you know, since the Civil War.
And as far as people responding to the flag or these monuments the Confederacy and the war generals and that kind of a thing. What did you learn from making the documentary about how that does affect people who are walking by it every day, black and white? Logan?
I think, you know, I'll talk about an example that at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. And this is a really interesting example that happened in, I forget, 3 or 4 years ago. And at the university, one of the first president of the university was General Robert E. Lee. And there's a chapel there. It's called Lee Chapel. And there is this kind of, I'm forgetting the word for it, but it's a statue of Lee kind of on his deathbed. And then there were these replica Confederate battle flags hanging in the corners, kind of surrounding the statue in the chapel. Mm-hmm. The chapel is kind of the center of university life. It's where kind of, students take a pledge, like on some of their first days of school to like kind of be more like Lee and kind of instill a lot of his values. And there was a group of African-American law students led by Angelica Hendricks and Brandon Hicks, and they basically, before they graduated, demanded that the university take those replica Confederate battle flags down. And they had a whole list of other demands, meaning, and one of those other ones was, we want the university to recognize the university's role in chattel slavery, and like who, and that enslaved people actually built much of the school. So, but as far as like the everyday, this is an everyday experience for many people, and it made them feel extremely uncomfortable. And it's kind of a marker. A lot of these symbols, as a flag or a monument or whatever, they're markers of, in regards to the Confederacy, they're markers of white space in a way. And they learned that term from Dr. David Pilgrim at the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, which is a whole other story. But I think people often overlook how embodied and how just like the everyday feeling that some people have walking around in a space that they don't see themselves represented in.
Joan Cashion, most of the monuments went up decades after the war ended. A group called the United Daughters of the Confederacy paid to have them made, often in northern cities, and put up as memorials to fallen soldiers. What's known about that group?
That group is part of a very self-conscious effort after the war to glamorize and validate the Confederacy. You know, Americans don't like to lose wars. Americans expect they're going to win. And the Confederate leadership was devastated when they lost the war. A lot of people died. The infrastructure was very heavily damaged. And there's a very self-conscious effort to make that war seem worthy anyway. And that's part of that cultural project. Kind of a culture war continues after the fighting stops in 1865. And they're very self-conscious about it. They're very determined. They're very energetic. Books roll off the presses. The monuments go up. This idea that all white Southerners supported the Confederacy and that the Confederacy was a worthy cause, it gets into the textbooks.
For 100 years.
Yes, it gets into popular culture. I mean, Exhibit A would be Gone with the Wind. You know, that's the pure product of that mentality. The novelist Margaret Mitchell, obviously she wrote the novel that the movie's based on. She was deeply nostalgic for the pre-Civil War South, and that was her idea of the perfect society. So this project has been going on for a long time, and they have been very successful at it. I mean, in some ways, they were much better at the culture war than they were at the actual fighting of the war.
Interesting way to put it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, the wants and needs of African Americans left behind in the South really didn't play into this at all.
Right.
They had no power.
Right. And these people are all advocates of white supremacy. So they lost the war and slavery was ended, but they're going to try to preserve white supremacy. And I think it's impossible to disconnect these monuments from slavery and white supremacy. I mean, they're historically connected in deep and profound ways. So that's why I think that they should come down if the local community supports it. I mean, this is a debate that has to take place at the community level everywhere.
Right.
There won't ever be any federal legislation on it.
Logan Jaffe, what about the flag? Does it still fly some places?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, I'll just say from my personal experience, I recently took a trip to the Outer Banks in North Carolina, and they are up and down, you know. I mean, I actually have, like, this ongoing tally. Like, every time I see one in my notebook, I, like, make a tally. And, yeah, I mean, you see them, I mean, in, like, DIY kind of places in front of people's homes.
Yeah.
Sometimes restaurants, like bumper stickers, you definitely see that. And I mean, I know that after the Charleston shooting and after Bree Newsom scaled the flagpole and took the flag down from the South Carolina State House, there were some major corporations. I mean, I think Walmart decided to not sell any sort of Confederate flag memorabilia anymore, but that also led to more people, you know, kind of figuring out ways to still make them on their own and kind of almost consolidate an effort, because now it's truly, I guess, I don't know if countercultural is the right word, but it's clear, there's more of a norm, I think, established even in the last couple of years for this not being an acceptable thing, for it being not as easy to make the excuse that it's just Southern pride.
Well, I've seen it here in Ohio. I mean, I saw it on a bumper sticker in Columbus, Ohio this year. In the spring of 2017, I saw it on a student's T-shirt on the OSU campus like a year or two ago.
Yeah.
So it has spread all over the country. I mean, it has been adopted, I think, by a certain kind of white conservative in lots of different places.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think one thing that really interests me is when it pops up in places that have no that were never part of the Confederacy, know, and you definitely see that. And that's why, I mean, I also agree that you cannot disassociate this kind of symbolism and a lot of these monuments from white supremacy.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about monuments, flags. When it comes to the Confederacy, obviously the flag was taken down in the South Carolina State House a few years ago after the mass shooting in the Charleston church. That just triggered the latest iteration of the movement against these monuments to the Confederacy. My guest, you're listening to Logan Jaffe. She's a visual journalist and producer at the New York Times. She's also co-producer of a documentary entitled Battle Flag. It questions the meaning of the Confederate flag more than 150 years after the end of the Civil War. Also with me, 19th century South historian Joan Cashin. She's a professor at Ohio State University. What do you think about these monuments? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are a few monuments in Ohio. We're going to talk about those coming up later on in the program. But what do you think in general? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Some refer to these monuments as art, Logan Jaffe, that is their historical artwork. And did you come across that when you reported on the flag?
I've not quite heard a strong argument for the monuments being considered art, though I would say, like, objectively, yeah, they could be art. But I think, one thing that stands out to me, I spent some time in Richmond and Richmond, Virginia, and there is an avenue there, and you might know about it, called Monument Avenue.
Yes, I've seen it. Monument Avenue, it's quite something.
Yeah, I think it's just like such a visual, like a perfect visual representation of so much of this debate. And so, you know, you have statue after statue, like down, like lining this, you know, very green, almost like Parkway Avenue in Richmond. And then at the very end is a smaller statue that was put up, you know, I'm don't quote me on this, but I think sometime in the 90s, of Arthur Ashe,
right,
the African-American tennis player. And I mean, that is one, I think, very clear story there of, ooh, maybe we need to be more inclusive somehow, but we don't quite know how. Here's a tennis player,
well,
you know?
Yeah, well, I asked that question earlier of Alan Blinder at the New York Times about, has anyone erected, have they ever erected any kind of statues commemorating the history, the life and times, the historical significance of African-Americans who were enslaved before the war? Joan Cashin, anything?
There's a project going on in Alabama right now, the Equal Rights Initiative, and they are trying to raise money to put up monuments to black people who were lynched after the war. But I cannot think of any monument that exists right now that's been put up to commemorate the suffering of African Americans in slavery.
Yeah.
There's a small plaque in Atlanta, Georgia, commemorating a Southern Unionist named James Andrews. He was part of a raid. He tried to steal a locomotive in Georgia during the war. He got caught. He got executed. There's a plaque memorializing him. But outside of Atlanta, there's this gigantic monument carved into Stone Mountain with all these Confederate figures. You know, it's enormous, and it's much, much bigger than this small plaque commemorating the Unionist James J. Andrews. And, you know, it's interesting. Kentucky was a border state a slave state that remained in the Union, but Kentucky has more Confederate monuments than it has pro-Union monuments.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it shows you just how successful this long-term project has been.
Mark in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted a response to what I'm about to say. Is that last summer, 4th of July parade, the city of Delaware and the Farm Bureau approved a what I call a truck float with the Confederate flag. And that was very disturbing to most members of our community. But my question is, how, in terms of the First Amendment right, how does that play into any into the decision makers whether to say yes or no to approve such a float on our celebrate on our day of the Fourth?
Mark, let's Joan Cashin, I would imagine freedom of expression comes into play here at
yes,
a certain level.
Absolutely, and if you feel an admiration for the Confederacy or a strong identification with the Confederate elite, you can express that privately. You know, you can wear a Confederate flag on a T-shirt. You can have a picture of Robert E. Lee in your house. But I think that the public square is different. In public, everything changes. And I think the display of these symbols in public is a very different kind of
issue. As something representing the government.
Yeah, well, and also it would presumably reflect the agreement of the public, that there's some kind of public consensus surrounding this. And that wasn't even true in 1861.
and
it's in the Confederacy, and it's not true now. So underneath this whole debate, there is a very serious misrepresentation. You know, the Confederacy and the flag have always been controversial. There were white Southerners who were so strongly opposed to the Confederacy, they served in the Union Army. The estimate by historians is 500,000 men from the Confederate states served in the Federal Army. So, and lots of historians think that's one reason the South lost the war, because it was so deeply divided. You know, the population, the white population, never united around the Confederate cause. So there were people who were alive during the war who objected to what the Confederate flag represented.
And I would say, Mark, you know, I it'd be interesting to know whether that float was, you know, the Sons of Confederate Veterans or some other group that, you know, doesn't, you know, have some sort of family ancestry or lineage to it. And, like, often there's a lot of overlap between groups like the Sons of Confederate Veterans or, you know, a group like the Virginia Flaggers, which is, you know, basically promoting, you know, use of the Confederate battle flag. Because I think and you're speaking about the First Amendment, I think it is within somebody's First Amendment rights. I think, though, perhaps an even more interesting question is, like, is it a question of taste? Because I've met people, and I spent some time with a Confederate reenacting troop, the 44th Georgia in Gettysburg, and I talked to some of those people in that troop, and some of the men said, you know, I donated money to a Civil War museum and I got this T-shirt with a Confederate battle flag and an American flag on it. But even then, they would choose not to wear it because they don't want to offend anybody. You know, so it and you know, if it's a matter, if it's like some of the Confederate veterans group, for example, it's, I feel like it's kind of a shame that the battle flag has become the symbol, and rather than, you know, if you are going to make the argument that this is your family ancestry, being more specific about what those flags were, or what, or how you want, you have a choice in how you want to express that, you know. And I think that's a choice that people may not feel like they have, or like they haven't really thought much about, because the battle flag has become the symbol, you know.
Well, okay. And you can't disconnect it from slavery. The Confederate flag is connected to slavery. The secession candidate in 1860, John Breckinridge, said that the slave state should consider secession. It should be an option if anyone tried to stop the expansion of slavery into the West, you know, the Trans-Mississippi West. So he himself in 1860 connects secession to slavery. And you can't disconnect it. You couldn't disconnect it during the war. You can't disconnected now. And I just also want to say this, you know, we've had lots of political controversies in the U.S. This is a big, noisy democracy. We have disagreed over a whole host of issues and one generation to the next. There have been all kinds of controversial political symbols. But I think that the Confederacy and slavery are different. They're in a special category because so many people suffered. There was so much human suffering because of slavery. And we as a nation have rejected that. You know, one side won the war and one side lost, and the slavery side lost.
Logan Jaffe, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you so much. It's a good conversation.
Logan Jaffe, visual journalist and producer at The New York Times and also co-producer of documentary film entitled Battle Flag. More coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 700 Confederate monuments remain in the United States. Some see them as a painful reminder of the nation's history of slavery and white supremacy. Others say they reflect a period of our nation's history and pay reverence to the Confederate soldiers who fought. Ohio has a handful of its own monuments representing the Confederacy. Still with us is OSU historian Joan Cashin. And joining us now is Heidelberg University anthropology professor and director of the Center for Historic and Military Archaeology. He's also a member of the Friends and Descendants of Johnson's Island Civil War Prison, David Bush. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne, for having me.
Appreciate it.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Tell us about the Civil War Cemetery on Johnson's Island. What's going on there? What do people see when they visit?
The cemetery is a very modest cemetery. There's 206 tombstones. They're fairly uniform white stone. And at the eastern end, there's a statue that was erected in 1910. A statue done by Moses Ezekiel, who had fought for the South. And it's a statue of a Confederate soldier sort of standing guard over the cemetery at that end. And there's a couple of larger monuments there. And there's a informational plaque at the western end of the cemetery as well. So it's in all about an acre and a half.
You said there's a couple larger monuments. Are they to the Confederacy or something ancillary?
Well, they were done about 10, 11 years ago, and they're monuments that stand almost 6 feet tall. They're granite stone. One of them is a monument that is supposed to have depicted all of the soldiers that are in the cemetery or died at Johnson's Island from the Confederacy, and the other one is a stone. They look like enlarged tombstones. And the other one is a stone that has a map of a ground-penetrating radar survey that was done by a group that was contracted with by the Daughters of the Confederacy. Both of those stones were commissioned by the Daughters of the Confederacy and were not in any way peer-reviewed by myself or any other historians that I know of.
Is there a distinction, David Bush, as far as your scholarship goes, between what was erected with funds from the United Daughters of the Confederacy and say that in that the Civil War soldier standing guard over the cemetery thing?
Is there a distinction? That's a good question. I both were done by groups that were associated with the Daughters of the Confederacy or the Sons of the Confederacy, Confederate veterans. But in the one case, the statue is very simple and just a statue commemorating the soldiers that are buried there. The other is a little less informative because it has a lot of information that's incorrect and frankly, I was a little surprised that the Department of Veterans Affairs that manages the cemetery didn't require you know, more peer review of the information that those were put up. It was as though, you know, the daughters had just the right to put up anything they wished. There's nothing terribly offensive. There's just a lot of misspellings and a lot of errors and things that could have been corrected proper, you know, could have been done properly.
Joan Cashin, a distinction for you when it comes to a cemetery and that kind of imagery, a typical imagery in a cemetery and maybe the monuments that the United Daughters of the Confederacy erected?
Well, that's a great question. If Sam Smith, who died in 1905, is buried in a family cemetery in Tennessee, that's up to his family to decide what to put on his tomb, obviously. But if a cemetery is federal property, and I think that's what Dave said, that this is owned by the U.S. government,
correct.
I feel uncomfortable about this UDC monument, and not just because of the spelling mistakes. I think that
it makes it official that way.
It valorizes one side over the other in ways that make me uncomfortable because it's a public property. It's a public place.
Brian in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been confused by the argument that it's a representation or an honor to the people of the Confederacy, the monuments and the Confederate flag. We don't, as a society, erect a monument to the British Army. We certainly don't erect monuments to the Japanese in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So I just always, I think, thought that was a hollow argument to perpetuate the white supremacist or the Confederacy kind of mentality. And it doesn't really hold any weight. I think it's a symbol of hate. And I just don't understand that argument.
So why glorify the losers? David Bush, as someone who studies such things, what about that?
That's something that we discuss a lot when we're in the cemetery. And I've discussed that when I've done visits of other battlefield sites and things in the South. And it particularly disturbs me that we glorify the battle aspect of the wars as opposed to the peaceful resolutions of the war.
Like, in other words, the generals and all that kind of stuff.
The generals and the state monuments. I mean, when you go to Gettysburg or Vicksburg or any of the battlefield sites, they have just thousands almost of monuments erected to these battlefield sites. And it doesn't matter if it's Union or Confederacy. I think that it's just something in our society that we look to that. In terms of looking, you know, at the Confederate itself, I've studied Johnson's Island now for 30 years, and you know, it is certainly an aspect of the wars that we need to study. We need to study how the prisoners were treated, and both sides, because both sides committed atrocities during the American Civil War, and those things need to be kept in the public memory. They can't be, and you know, I'm afraid that if we choose to, you know, allow any commemorative aspects of of the war, then we start going down that road where we start to eliminate, you know, part of that history. And that history is very important to us. They were all, in essence, American citizens.
Sure.
At some
and
point.
I agree with that. I think we need more monuments. I would like to see monuments to the Union Army soldiers from the South who served.
We don't have those. We do have one at the State House.
And there's a few in Kentucky.
Here and there, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And if we're going to put up monuments to the Civil War, I agree with what Dave said. I would like to see a range of monuments. But as he's saying, the military gets raised up above all other aspects of experience, and a tiny number of famous white men are typically being put on those pedestals, literally.
Brian, thanks to Brian for that call. Yeah, go ahead, David.
I'm sorry. If I could add just one thing, I know I've studied, you know, the prison system for so long that I'm very biased towards that. But that's always part of the dark side of history, is when you're dealing with the prison systems. And those are things that we really need to explore more and make more public. And I'm not sure if, you know, monuments to that are appropriate, but we certainly need to recognize. I mean, I work at one of the most important prisons in the North, and you know, it's privately owned, and we hardly get any visitors, and it's almost shunned up here, and it's really a shame.
So I have a question, Dave. Who owns the property itself? Is it privately owned, or is it the U.S. government?
Well, the government owns the cemetery, the acre mm-hmm. and a half or so, the part of that. And then mm-hmm. the Friends and Descendants, a nonprofit historic preservation group, bought 17 acres of the prison compound and mm-hmm. Fort Johnson.
Okay. Hmm. Interesting.
Stanley in Lithopolis, you're on the air. Hi, Stanley.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I think people mistake. They have to look at each representation when you're talking about a general. Let me give you an example. Robert E. Lee, when he was a student at West Point for 4 years, mm-hmm. to this day, no cadet has went through 4 years without a single demerit. Also considering that he married a relative of George Washington,
mm-hmm.
Arlington.
So what are you saying? I mean, what's the bottom line here?
Okay. What I'm trying to say mm-hmm. is, you have to look at the history of these people. Now, if you're talking about Bradford Forrest that founded the Ku Klux Klan, yeah, I'd say tear any monument to him down. But tearing down monuments to Lee.
Of course, Robert E. Lee was offered the command of the Union Army in the spring of 1861. Winfield Scott thought that he was the most gifted officer in the officer corps. And we know now that Lee hesitated. It took him a while to make up his mind. And then he finally said no, he would fight for the Confederacy. But even Robert E. Lee, who was often held up as a kind of icon, had moments of doubt and hesitation. And of course, he also had relatives in the Union Army. He and his wife both had relatives who were pro-Union white Southerners.
So, Stanley, thanks a lot for that call. So there's a place for remembering people. Are statues, adulating them, the way to do it on public property? And David Bush, when something like what has happened in New Orleans recently, where they've taken down all the remaining statues in New Orleans, adulating the Confederacy and the generals, et cetera, does that send a shiver down the spine of people out there at the, in the Friends and Descendants of Johnson's Island Civil War prison?
Well, it certainly has raised that question, and you know, I've been asked that more and more recently about the statue at the cemetery. And Moses Ezekiel statue is very commemorative in nature, and it's just a statue that represents a soldier, and it doesn't imply, I don't think, anything other than just, you know, who's buried there. So I would be. And it symbolizes the cemetery and the island quite a bit. So I would be very, very much against, you know, taking that down, because it served as the only way of recognizing, Johnson's Island at this point. So I think there is a place for some of those statues. It's not commemorating a specific soldier. It's just a generic Confederate soldier.
I have an email from Michael who says he recommends the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana if listeners are interested in learning more about slavery in the South and seeing a proper memorial to those Black Americans who suffered in the Old South. Also, an email from Timothy asking how many statues of Abraham Lincoln exist in the former Confederate States of America. I would venture to guess, just guessing, but Not many, if any. And an email from Brad says, I can't think of anything that would be more demoralizing than an African-American student attending a public school named for an individual who fought to keep them from being able to pursue freedom and education. David Bush, I want to thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
David Bush, he's an anthropology professor, director of the Center for Historic and Military Archaeology at Heidelberg University, and a member of the Friends and Descendants of Johnson's Island Civil War Prison. Also, Joan Cashin, thanks to you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Joan Cashin is an expert on the 19th century South and is a professor at OSU. Thanks for listening. Kyle McKinnon produce this show today. Thanks, Kyle. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.